first, I want to start with a critical view of C.P. Snow. I have to confess, I didn't know C.P. Snow at all until I read his introduction to A Mathematician's Apology by G.H. Hardy. And Hardy, of course, was known to every Indian student because it was he who plucked the mathematical genius Ramanujan out of obscurity and brought him to Cambridge. And in the introduction, it was obvious that C.P. Snow and G.H. Hardy were very good friends, despite being from Trinity and Christ's. But the reality is I couldn't think of two people who were more different in some ways. Yes, they were both intellectuals of a sort, but C.P. Snow struck me as someone who was really what I would describe, if I don't offend most of the people here, as a London man. That is to say, someone interested in the corridors of power, you know, how things work, etc. And whereas Hardy was really almost a stereotypical Cambridge academic. He was very shy, very reserved. In fact, he felt that nothing he did would ever have any applications. And, you know, unlike C.P. Snow, to paraphrase Donald Knuth, the famous computer scientist, he was more interested in getting to the bottom of things than staying on top of things. So what did C.P. Snow, what are some of the issues he raised? Well, the essay itself, I mean, the lecture itself, is about the seemingly unbridgeable chasm between the arts and humanities on the one hand and the sciences on the other, with each side not even being not only ignorant of the achievements of the other side, but unable to even comprehend their language. And the result was an incommunicable divide. Now, in particular, Snow also complained of the asymmetry of the social acceptability of ignorance in the two spheres. For example, he pointed out that it was considered perfectly acceptable in society for someone in the humanities not to have heard of the second law of thermodynamics. They felt no sense of shame about not knowing what it was. But, he said, not to have read War and Peace, La Cousine Bette, and La Chartreuse de Parme is not to be educated. I'm afraid that the voluminous Tolstoy novel has remained on my list of books to read for the last 40 or 50 years, and I look forward to it as a retirement project. And as for the other two, I've not even heard of them. So Snow's neat divide certainly doesn't apply to me. In the earlier discussions of the two cultures, Peter Lachman, the former biological secretary and vice president of the Royal Society, notes, Snow says very little about historians or social scientists or economists, and music and the performing arts also do not figure among his humanities scholars. Scientific culture, in an analogous way, is restricted almost entirely to physics, and the biological sciences are largely ignored. He regards ignorance of the Yang and Li experiment of 1957, showing contradiction of parity, as culpable. And here Lachman says that he feels chastened. But he makes no mention of Watson and Crick's 1953 paper on the structure of DNA, which did so much to fire the revolution in molecular biology, the implications of which have spread across and beyond the two cultures in the consciousness of the public. So we can see that even in 1959, Snow had a very particular point of view that wasn't perhaps, you know, representative of its own time. The real problem is that knowledge has become highly compartmentalized. For example, science is now so technical that it's not understandable even to other scientists outside a narrow field. There's a lot of talk in academic circles about the evils of publishing in journals with high impact factors. But so far, nobody has found a good alternative solution, because the underlying reason is that we're unable to judge work even slightly outside our own narrow expertise, and we rely on these journals to make our judgments for us. Similarly, it's not clear to me that a playwright or an artist will understand deconstructionist theory and literary criticism, or how historians go about reaching their conclusion. the chasm seems to be not just between two cultures, but between the many individual branches of knowledge. There is, however, a different chasm that has always existed, in which science as a whole is on one side of the divide. And that is the difference between a rational and empirically based ways of knowing and other ways based on faith and reasoning or emotion and instinct, or possibly a sense of ethics and morality. The Enlightenment and the development of the modern empirical method have driven an unparalleled growth of knowledge in the last few centuries. And at its heart is the reliance on reproducible and demonstrable evidence above all else. The Royal Society's motto, nullius in verba, on nobody's word, epitomizes this. There are now claims made that science itself is not objective, and a lot of its ideas and beliefs are cultural artifacts, and that its underlying philosophy has been dismissed as scientism, an exaggerated belief in the power of science. I hesitate to say this in the British Academy, but some of these emanate from the humanities departments of universities, who perhaps have what I call a touch of science envy, a resentment of the excessive influence of science and technology, both in society and in academia today, and the arrogance of scientists who consider themselves as the sole bearers of truth. They should realize that such arrogance is not just one of scientists to non-scientists. Even within scientists, there's a hierarchy of arrogance, and I have sort of descended that hierarchy, as David Willetts pointed out in his introduction. There's a famous XKCD cartoon, those of you who know what XKCD is, a very funny cartoonist who talks about sort of science issues, called Purity, and it describes a reverse hierarchy that goes from sociology, which is merely applied psychology, which is merely applied biology, which is merely applied chemistry, which is merely applied physics, to mathematics, which sort of stands on its own. However, those in the so-called hard sciences are realizing that not only do they not have all the answers, but their methods are not useful to study problems at different levels of complexity and scale. It is futile to understand the brain by trying to solve the Schrodinger equations for all the atoms in the brain. So the reaction to get back to this difference between science and non-science, the reaction to the power of science and possibly its accompanying arrogance can lead some in the humanities to question the objectivity of science and the truths revealed by it. Everything is said to be cultural. However, carried to their logical extreme, such claims are nonsense. Nobody can doubt that quantum mechanics and nuclear physics, both based on quite abstract and non-intuitive concepts, led to nuclear weapons, or that the theory of relativity, which has to do with the fabric of space and time, allows accurate location in our smartphones. Nobody would question the objectivity of the existence of these objects. The laws of physics apply equally in India, where I grew up, as they do in Cambridge, where I now live. Although culturally, India and Cambridge are quite far apart, an interest in cricket notwithstanding. But scientists should take note that while we think of ourselves as objective and rational guardians of the truth, in fact, science itself shows that under a thin veneer of rationality, we're all, scientists and non-scientists alike, highly emotional beings. Daniel Kahneman's brilliant book, Thinking Fast and Slow, shows many examples of how humans instinctively act in one way when rational thought would argue otherwise. If we scientists do not acknowledge our emotional selves, we risk not being able to convince society about crucial issues. Those of us who are social scientists or psychologists, the so-called soft sciences, actually understand this and are playing an increasingly important role in shaping knowledge and policy. And we must recognize that literature, art, and music can approach reality in a different way from scientists and reveal fundamental truths about ourselves by appealing to our underlying emotional and moral selves. Given our nature, arguments cannot be made on cold empirical logic alone. For example, despite scientific evidence to the contrary, there is persistent belief that homeopathy is beneficial and vaccination or GM crops are dangerous. One side appeals to evidence and data based on statistics and randomized controls. The other plays on our instinctive fears about anything that is new and perceived as unnatural. A recent political example of this could be seen in the referendum debate. One side had a lot of analytical arguments about non-tariff barriers and free trade, supply chains, and the effect of all these on GDP and employment. The other side talked about identity, sovereignty, and control. They were not really having the same debate, and the chasm between the two sides is an example of two cultures that just talk past each other. Bridging the gap between scientists and non-scientists is becoming ever more important. Firstly, science is a public and publicly funded enterprise, so everyone has a stake in it. Secondly, we live in an increasingly technological world in which decisions will be made by governments, corporations, and other entities that affect us all. It is important for the public not only to be aware of this, but to be able to participate intelligently in debates on the key issues. How do we go forward with artificial intelligence and its effects on jobs and society? Should we allow genome editing of humans and thus risk creating multiple classes of humans? Who owns the data about ourselves that's increasingly beyond our ability to control? If scientists want to be able to bridge this chasm, we have to shed some of our arrogance and recognize that literature and art may offer us an alternative way of approaching and describing things that can resonate better with people. This does not mean compromising our values of evidence-based analysis. Rather, it means that we need to recognize that our emotional side is just as real and well-established as all of the other evidence and needs to be included in any analysis that we do to take things forward. We in science need to understand other ways of approaching ideas and knowledge, but those in the humanities and arts owe it to themselves to at least try to become familiar with some of the most basic concepts of science. If we are to do this, we need to ask whether our current system of segregating students at age 16 is sensible. The British educational system today is one of the narrowest in the world, with the average number of A-levels being taken being just 2.7. And so it's even narrower than it was a decade or two ago. Countries that formerly used the British system, for example, many former colonies, have now abandoned it. If we are to bridge the chasm between the various strands of culture and knowledge, we must broaden our educational system and educate future generations in both the humanities and sciences through secondary school and possibly beyond. Otherwise, we will continue to have the chasm and face the 21st century with a handicap. Thank you very much.